Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining us in this latest edition of the BDS Monitor Live. In this time of COVID-19, we know that everybody's cooped at home, and here at SPME, we are continuing to work hard, a bit online, but we're trying to add ongoing content and information that everybody can benefit from. And we hope to start a little to increase the volume of frequency of calls over the next few weeks. And you will be receiving invitations to all of that. We have today our friend and colleague, Alex Jaffe. Next week, we will have David Menashri, who will talk about Iran. So we will have these more and connect. Notwithstanding the news of the day, which of course is putting a damper on a lot of other things, positively and negatively, and we'll get into that today. Those of you who've been with us before, and for those of you who have not, let me just go over the housekeeping issues so everybody knows how the format works. Alex will talk for about 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll go into a Q&A. Those of you who are logged in the computer, you see an icon of a hand. Should you have a question, and we encourage as many questions as possible, please hit the icon and I will be able to unmute you. You could also do the same prompt when you're logged into the phone and I'll be able to unmute you as well. If you want to write a question, you can also use the opportunity through the computer to type in your question, and I'll be able to read your question. If you have questions after the call, as always, you can reach us at BDS Monitor, one word, bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we will do our best to respond in a timely fashion. Welcome. Thank you again for joining us. And without further ado, Alex, the floor is yours.
Okay, terrific. Well, two things to begin. One, let me hope that everyone is well and stays well, and all of your loved ones are well. This is a very difficult time for all of us, worrying about especially older relatives. Our older relatives, so it's a difficult situation. Also, on a more technical note, for some reason, one of my neighbors at the end of the block is cutting down a tree today, so I apologize if you hear that noise. This is one of the challenges of working at home. I would move to another room, but all of the rooms in my house are taken up. People either teaching or learning online. So there you are. It's a different, very different situation for higher education in particular. I just got an email from my daughter's college saying that we will not be allowed back to pick up the rest of her stuff for a minimum of 10 weeks. And I think that's indicative of what will be a very changed landscape for this industry, higher education industry. I looked it up the other day. It's a $600 billion a year industry in the United States. There are something like 400,000 Chinese students alone studying in the United States. And I don't think anybody has a good idea of how it's going to look at the other end. certainly, there's going to be pressures every way to stay home and also to get the kids the hell out of the house and back to school. But we're going to see. One of the constants, though, is that BDS is going to continue and anti-Semitism. dismaying and enlightening things to come out of this crisis has been an illustration of how the BDS movement is a subset of global dissent, has very quickly adapted to the new circumstances of higher education and global education as a whole. So we'll get into a few details. Higher education is shut down, I think, basically across the board. That Liberty University reopened, which lining is that this shutdown came on the verge of Israel apartheid week, so to speak, which really has, so the crisis is the kibosh on the keystone BDS event of the year on campuses. That said, before the shutdown, there were a couple of significant developments that I want to talk about briefly, and then get into the way that the global pandemic has been interacting with BDSs as a whole. So I think the first thing is the continuation of a story of a situation that's been going on for some time. At Brown University, a joint faculty student advisory committee, oversees or comments on, doesn't oversee, comments on the university should invest from companies doing this in Israel. And I think that this is a significant development, not because the committee itself has any particular power. It really doesn't. It's a sort of odd and in some respects unique structure of a joint faculty on campus, as almost all processes on campus has been interrupted by the current crisis. But this is something to look at going forward. One of the main features of the BDS movement is that it always looks for the weakest, or it instinctively seeks out the weakest kinds of organizational links in order to press its case against Israel and supporters of Israel. And in this case, it found one at Brown. And I've said this in the BDS Monitor and other publications before over the last year or two. I have a sneaking suspicion, a sinking suspicion that at some point along the line, some institution like Brown, which prides itself very much on its left liberal orientation and clientele, that is to say, its student body, and employees, that is to say its faculty, will actually take this step. I don't know where and when, but I think it might happen. And in this respect, I think that the current global pandemic will have an impact, because necessarily university corporations will be adjusting their investment portfolios. For example, the travel industry, the hotel industry, the airline industry, the cruise line industry have nearly collapsed or are in a state of disarray, let's say, even though the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 1,620 points at the moment. These industries will not be coming back very soon. Universities, like other investors, are going to have to adapt to this. And because these are among the industries that have been targeted specifically by the BDS movement. So, for example, there's a holding company, and I'm blanking out on its name, but it owns companies like Bookings.com and Travelocity and some of these others. Their stock is going to go down. I'm sure it is down significantly. When universities, among other investors, dump those stocks, the BDS movement will, I think, absolutely claim it was because of their pressure. Some of these companies are targeted by black doing business in the so-called occupied territories. So I think we all have to be prepared for a kind of new rhetorical environment. I don't think that in practical economics, the universities divesting from these companies or selling their stock is going to make much difference. Universities, which are, as I've said many times in the past, and it's not my line, universities are basically hedge funds with HR departments and a small number. Their portfolios, but more and more and more, the BDS movement is focusing in on investments beyond the iconic kinds of industrial firms that it has targeted in the past, like Caterpillar or other defense contractors. So we're going to hear more about this in the future. There was a newly formed group, BDS group at Harvard. Only came about in the last 6 or 8 weeks or thereabouts, which looked specifically at its investment portfolio and targeted not only Caterpillar, Grumman, things like that, but also these travel-oriented companies. So again, I think we're going to hear more about this in the future. In other kinds of campus news, there are a variety of smaller events that are going on, the usual sorts of BDS resolutions and anti-Israel and anti-Semitic agitation, a group at Florida State University, the Students for Justice in Palestine group at Florida State, started a campaign to target FSU students who had attended the AIPAC conference in Washington at the very end of February, beginning that these students cleansing and genocide and all the usual kinds of nonsensical deal of traction on campus as so-called human rights rhetoric. One of the more significant developments, though, I think, is at Columbia, another bellwether institution with a long tradition of, on the one hand, center for BS activity, and on the other hand, one of the centers for, let's say, elite American Jewish student life on campus. So there is a referendum, a campus-wide referendum, I believe it has two pages, that's scheduled for about a week and a half from now. We'll be online rather than in person, so obviously online is online voting is open to all sorts of shenanigans, and we can expect that. But in an interesting turn of events, the president of Columbia, First Amendment scholar Lee Bollinger, came out with a very strong statement, and I'll read just one line. Issued a statement opposing BDS and opposing anti-Semitism, expressing concern for the state of his campus and campuses in general these days, and opposing the BDS referendum since, quote, it imposes a standard on this particular political issue that is not right when one considers similar issues in other countries and other contexts around the world. To my mind, that is unwise and analytically flawed. So this is a very strong statement. And we should recall that Bollinger in particular and college presidents as a class across the country have opposed BDS, have had to balance free speech issues on campus. And they have, but they also have to take, you might say, measure the climate on their campus. Last month had put out a more ambiguous statement, which I won't read to you, saying that something to the effect that that the that the BDS resolution, referendum and BDS in general really couldn't be adopted, but because there wasn't a kind of campus consensus on the issue. And I read that, possibly mistakenly, kind of statement that on the one hand sort of encouraged people to organize and create a consensus, and also in a backhanded way disapproved of advocacy or activism in favor of generating such a consensus. It's hard to say, and you know, it's I don't envy college presidents by any means. It's possibly the worst job that you can have on campus. So it's very interesting, but it's very interesting that Bollinger has now, I think in response to some pressure, including from SPME and other groups, taken a stand that excuse me, faculty letter generated by another group, which has at last yesterday or so 70 plus signatures from the believe are not but and this has been for forever the classic pattern that the humanities and social sciences are majority. There. And here I'll say quite old research that I've done with 10 years ago, which actually did opinion polls among hundreds of faculty members to try and get a sense of where they stood on these kinds of issues. Were generated suggesting that for one thing, something around 8% of faculty members in the humanities and social sciences were virulently hated Israel, and as an absolute corollary, pretty much as long as where there are all sorts of social, not at least of which the of it being, you know, international kinds of. Doesn't promote an American perspective or American interests, but something quite else. And that other thing that it promotes is, as we know, very, very much tied up with an identification in an identification with the Palestinian cause. The Palestinian cause is represented by and large today, to a shocking extent, by the BDS movement. So where are we on campus? And the semester is not over, but in some respects, it is as good as over. There will be more resolutions, I suppose. Government will be undertaking its very opaque, shenanigan-ridden activities by email and Zoom or however they're going to do it, but it's kind of over, and it's been a mixed year. We'll see in a month or so if anything dramatically changes. And this Columbia business will be a very interesting data point to continue. So I want to get into two other areas, though, very, very quickly. We've plenty of time for for questions. One is the situation in U.S. politics, which is also in some ways kind of on hold, at least in terms of presidential politics, or so it seems from where I am sitting in the New York area. Campaigns have been suspended except for very awkward sorts of webinars and Zoom sessions and online things from two Democratic candidates. But it's worth noting here that support from the movement and from a variety of other groups are about Israel, let me insert here my stock reminder that does not take a stance on political candidates. What I hope to do is more descriptive than anything else, and nobody's going to tell you how to vote. On the other hand, the Sanders campaign continues to be extremely extremely problematic. There was an endorsement that it received maybe a week or two ago from an imam in Dearborn, Michigan, who had, among other things, he claimed that ISIS was an Israeli conspiracy and had denounced gay marriage, which forced the Sanders campaign and its BDS supporting campaign manager, Faiz Shakir, into an awkward sort of condemnation of these early statements. Oh, we didn't really know about this. And we very much disapprove of these kinds of statements. On the other hand, it just hired an individual by the name of Philip Agnew, also known as Umi Sela, as a senior campaign advisor, and who's gone on the record for a long time denouncing Israel and Israel and denouncing Zionism as a racist ideology. So the Sanders campaign continues to try and have it both ways, as well as attracting support from well-known celebrities such as Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. I think more important in some ways are the appearance of a number of what I would call down market Democratic candidates. I'll point to one, Marcy Newman in a district in Illinois, who's a BDS supporter, longtime opponent of Israel, who won her primary against an incumbent Democrat who is a strong supporter of Israel, and it's a very odd situation. This district, to compound the oddness, just to complete the thought, the Republican, the only Republican who was running in the primary, was actually an Illinois Nazi who was disavowed and shunned by the Republican Party. So he lost, so I guess that's a good thing. She won, which is maybe not such a good thing. And the recently formed group Democratic Majority for Israel declined to support Marcy Newman's incumbent opponent because he was opposed to abortion. And he was the last Democrat in the House of Representatives who was pro-life. So in this very complicated calculus, even among the Jewish Democratic establishment. They made the decision to dump him in favor and tacitly allow BDS support her. And she is one of a number of down market candidates for the House and also for local office who are virulently anti-Israel and pro BDS. And these kinds of grassroots of changes will and already has changed the shape of politics in houses of representatives. And I think it's fair to predict that in the longer term, that these folks will make local state level anti-BDS legislation much more difficult, if not impossible, here and there. So let me just, but we'll see where this goes. And you know, the presidential campaign, I assume, will resume in earnest to thrill and delight us all at some point. So we will get back to these issues in due course. But this is something significant to watch. But let me conclude with once again, I think with an example that proves the point about the anti-Semitic nature of the BDS movement. And that's the response to the global pandemic from BDS supporters, and which has been very much as one, excuse me, would expect. So the BDS group, if not now, and you know, we'll add the somewhat unpersuasive, if not ludicrous, caveat that they are anti-occupation, so-called, rather than fully BDS, have been relentlessly attacking the Israeli government for allegedly not permitting medical supplies to enter Gaza and the West Bank, which of course is just a flat-out lie, which has been echoed by folks like Rashida Tlaib, who and Ilhan Omar, who parenthetically have been very active trying to get sanctions against Iran lifted on the same basis, even though the sanctions regimes specifically permit medical supplies to be imported. So these are kinds of very predictable opportunistic choices made by the BDS movement, that the Israeli occupation, that so-called, that is, you know, crushing the people of Gaza, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think more disturbing in a way are slips that are made routinely by BDS advocates, usually via social media, particularly Twitter. Twitter is, as I've said before on these calls, absolutely the worst medium possibly ever created in humankind, but it's the most telling because it's the most immediate, it's the most real, it's the most spontaneous. You get a real picture into the heart of darkness. That so one prominent BDS supporter, Mirav Zonstein, tweeted last week, I think, quote, 6 million Jewish Israelis will now get a taste of what around the same number of Palestinians have experienced for over half a century, referring to the complete and total shutdown of Israel to incoming and outgoing and the confinement to quarters of everybody. To which Sarah Leah Whitson, formerly of the group Human Rights Watch, now of a new phony baloney foreign policy research group. She, Whitson responded, let's see, such a tiny taste, missing a tablespoon of blood. So these kinds of, you know, anti-Semitic classic tinges, a little too real, which were later walked back, of course. Give us a picture of the visceral hatred that BDS supporters have, and BDS supporters who are lodged in so-called human rights organizations, so-called progressive organizations, like the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and so on. And so, you know, I'll just conclude here by saying that, you know, for better and for worse, and one never knows really which is better and which is worse, the mask drops. That's really my point. That in crises such as this, the mask drops, and we have a much truer picture of the feelings of and the intelligence and the kind of people who are on the other side, never willing to let a crisis go to waste, but more than that, letting their essential hatred of Israel and Jews come through. And that's not going to change. So at the very least, we can be sitting at home listening to webinars and reading, torturing ourselves with Twitter and social media, and come out of it slightly more informed about where we are and who we're up against. So, okay. So on that note, let me shut up and let's take a bunch of questions.
Great. Well, thank you, Alec. That's great as always in unpacking the reality that we're now in. The floor is now open, everybody. Please, if you have a question, you know, hit the icon and I'll be able to unmute you, and we will go from there. In the meantime, you know, Alex, while you were talking, I was thinking, I mean, again, this is 2 points, I guess, to add a little bit. One, of course, is the detachment from the reality. I mean, to the comment, you know, to your correct comment about the issue regarding medical supplies, of course, there is no conversation about the fact that the Islamist Hamas group, of course, denied medical supplies in order to keep and maintain the Palestinian stasis in that regard, while indeed playing the game. And of course, none of that trickles down into what the BDS movement or people like Yehudim and others sell to their constituents about the reality on the ground. Again, highlighting the disconnect between the actual connection between Israelis and Palestinians versus the anti-normalization campaign that is furthered in any way, shape, or form, never to miss an opportunity when it comes to talking about their cause, which of course is you know, par for the case. The other thing that came out, you know, which I'm sure you saw as well, was that it came out of South Africa from a pro-BDS movement there. They went a little bit more simplistic and more stupefied, trying to argue that the messaging coming out of the Israeli health ministry were intentionally only done in Hebrew in order not to discuss this with, you know, the Arab neighbors or Arab Israelis, not to mention the amount of Arab Israeli doctors who have been involved in dealing with COVID-19 all over the place. Making clear that we are here to serve our patients, not asking for their background or their religion, for that matter.
Right. Well, this is, you know, this is, again, classic sort of behavior. It's not really about the issues. It's not really about the facts. It's not really about the reality on the ground, which is more complicated at the very least than any of us realize. It's about having a narrative, having a standpoint and sticking to it. So And the fact that this goes on relentlessly throughout a crisis, I think, is telling. But again, what are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to expect? It's sure. I have no other expectation for how this could possibly play out, considering the people who were involved, who are relentless, who are obsessed, who are single-minded, and I, again, you know, I find myself repeating myself, and I apologize to those of you who've heard this before. It's like this because this is a religious movement. It's part of a substitute religion that, particularly for Westerners who are involved in the BDS movement, it's an article of religious devotion that you have to attack, and that Israel and its Jews in particular are a kind of unique, transcendent, existential evil. Because it's sad thinking that, believing that, acting on that, acting in very ritualized kinds of fashion, satisfies a kind of religious need that is otherwise missing in a lot of people, or it is grafted onto religion, as in the case of certain churches, and certainly in the case of many Islamic believers, it is an article of religious devotion. So I think we shouldn't be surprised by any of this. We shouldn't be surprised anymore by the hostility that individuals in America express towards visibly different, or visible Jews. I think that's the phrase that we're all supposed to use now. You know, Hasidic Jews who dress and behave differently. That and in times of social stress such as this, it's almost invariably the case that anti-Semitism as a whole goes up. So none of this is especially surprising, in a sense. It's dismaying, and it would be nice to think that we had evolved otherwise. But my feeling again is because this is, it's religion. It's irrational, and nobody can get beyond it.
Right. No, agreed. Let's take a question, and we'll go back to you, Alex. So I know that our friend and colleague Gabe Bram has a question. Let me try to unmute Gabe here. Gabe, can you hear us?
Thanks, Asaf, and Alex. Thank you for a great report, as always. I have a kind of a big picture question for you. I hear you when you say that BDS is a kind of a religion, a kind of religious movement. I see intersectionality very much that way too, and I see that as kind of the essence of political correctness. I teach at a university. I teach at a regional university, Northern Michigan University, and I've been in this business now for decades. It's looked to me for a long time like political correctness has the attributes of a religion. You can question it kind of, but people get upset. You really can't question feminism or, for example, or any of the tenets of political correctness. And so I wonder, big picture, about the fate of the university, which is a petri dish for a lot of bad stuff, including BDS, but not limited to it. Arthur Millick at Heritage has a new article out that I recommend to you, Preventing Suicide by Higher Education, in the spring issue of National Affairs. And its argument is parallel to a new book by John M. Ellis, The Breakdown of Higher Education. They both conclude that higher education is hopeless, it's unreformable, it's got to be defunded, because it's so harmful to the society. It's harmful with BDS to our interests as Jews and as Zionists But it's harmful in a myriad of other ways. Do you think that as we fight BDS, we can aim to renew and revivify the universities, bring them back to their core mission, promote viewpoint diversity, and hope to revive the universities? Or is John M. Ellis correct in his breakdown of higher education? Say the time has passed. We've got to face what these and they should be defunded.
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes. The long answer is, you know, if we'd had this conversation, say, 3 months ago, so I'd get up every morning and like many people, I waste way too much time on Twitter. But it suddenly occurred to me this morning that I wrote something incredibly droll that, you know, the relevance of social theory has never been higher. If we had listened to social theorists, we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in. And the point being that this global pandemic, I think, has proven just how utterly and completely useless and wasteful vast swaths of the university actually are, because they can't make a contribution. They won't make a contribution. I said someplace else on Twitter because, you know, I think the virus is gendered, like gravity, which I hope in my pithy, thwarted comedy writing kind of way, gets across the point that they have nothing to say. They have no valuable contribution to make at a time of a unique global crisis for which, you know, the majority of so-called expertise in the humanities and social sciences is completely and utterly irrelevant. And it's useless, it's detrimental. But as to the future, I think the crisis is also putting us in a different place there. There was a report out, and I don't remember by who, back in the fall, that predicted X number of small colleges were going to go under by the year 2025 or whatever the date was. And now, as this crisis continues to unfold, and people continue, like me, you know, as a parent of a college student, like, okay, when are we going to get our room and board? The crisis is putting huge strain on the finances of institutions all across the country, probably all across the world. And a lot of institutions aren't going to come out of this. I don't know who. Unfortunately, the worst ones in terms of our issues, in terms of Israel and BDS and treatment of Jews and the larger questions that our problems are embedded in, the questions of the humanities and social sciences, the questions of some kind of respect for Western tradition as something lodged within global tradition, and so on, something that isn't destructive, detrimental, deconstructive in the non-specific sense. I don't know what's going to come out of it. I would like to think, on the one hand, that a lot of kids are going to be inspired to become doctors and scientists after this and stop wasting their time with critical theory. I think that there's an argument that this is an opportunity for another kind of Sputnik moment, that if we had leadership in this country that understood the challenges that we're in, not only the specific ones with respect to health and medicine, but the broader ones in terms of science and engineering and manufacturing and economics, that there would be a tremendous reorientation towards towards the kinds of things that helped this country put a man on the moon all those years ago. I don't know that that's going to happen. I think that there will be colleges and universities that don't come back, that will be crippled, and this will be a bad thing, and it'll be a good thing. I think that students, the clients, will be chastened to some extent. But as for the larger question of, you know, these institutions as a whole, are they valuable? Can they survive? Will they survive? Well, I think they'll survive as long as people, you know, are willing to shell out. And until, and I've been saying this for more than 15 years, that until people come up with, you know, they vote with their checkbooks, and until donors start withholding their money, and until there are more than just Peter Thiel and a handful of industry leaders who say, it doesn't do any good, you don't need it, what's it for? And you can get by with certificates and vocational training and so on and so on, I think we're going to be stuck with this very dysfunctional, very wasteful kind of system that's in a sense too big to fail. $600 billion industry, that's huge. We can't let that fail. $1.5 trillion of outstanding student loans, which have crippled a generation or two generations of students, which have put tons of money into the pockets of administrators and banks and grifters at all levels of the university, not so much faculty members. I think, you know, cleaning out these stables is going to be a very, very difficult job, because the industry is so complex and it spends so much money, and it's such an important part of not only the country's bottom line, but the sort of larger global position of the country. I mean, there are 300,000 plus Chinese students alone who come to them. There are something like, I don't know, 70 or 80,000 Saudi students who come here. It's a huge export industry. I mean, we import the students, but, you know, they come and spend their money at Disneyland, so to speak. And we export their expertise. And then we import, engineers from India and other places to replace American workers. So it's all part, it's one small part of a very much larger series of political economic kinds of questions, which I don't know that we're actually going to address, because in this country I don't see that we have the means and the patience and in some respects the wisdom, maybe the intelligence, to address such complex kinds of problems. I don't know whether that answers your question, but
yeah, thanks, Alex, very much for your response. I'll send you some links on this, and keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Thank you, Gabe. Thanks, Alex. I'm just trying to keep the call moving and keeping an eye on the clock as well. So we have, two more questions that were emailed to us. So let me read them to you, Alex. We could try to tackle them as well. Actually, the short one, let me start with the second one that was related to your comment or tweet about the virus being a gendered like gravity. That was asked by Steve Bernstein. He wants to know if there's something we can a citation for that, or that is that you?
That's all me. It's on Twitter somewhere. Right. You know, it's citations are always welcome. But you know, the I thought, or at least it seemed to me when I was kind of goofing around at 7 o'clock this morning on Twitter, that captured some of the essence of the problem. And, you know, these things have no, they have no relationship to reality, and they have no relevance in the world. And at most they're amusing to think about, but it's bemusing and downright horrifying if you take these kinds of, this kind of thing seriously. So,
and we agree and we concur. So thank you, Stephen, for that question. Jack has a question as well, Jack Salzberg. So Jack wants to know if we can have a breakdown on the percentage of the university of Jewish students who support BDS, those who are neutral, and those who are opposed, as far as the breakdown of this, the larger arena. I don't know if you have that at your tip of your fingers.
You know, it's a very interesting question, and it's an important question, but I don't know of that number, and I don't know of anybody who really has that number. There might be like a Pew Trust survey somewhere, or Hillel might have done a survey, but it's not ringing a bell. If I were to guess, and I'll just guess here and make up some numbers, I would think that the number of real Jewish BDS supporters on campus is very low, that it's, you know, 5%, something like that. But it's very they're very vocal. And because Jewish BDS supporters and vocal groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now and, you know, all of the other kinds of alphabet soup of groups, because they are given a kind of pride of place in the campus landscape as key intersectional allies for SJPs and Muslim student associations, that their influence is very much magnified, and that this small percentage, 5%, 10%, again, purely made up numbers, have the capacity to intimidate the rest who are on some kind of more normal distribution curve from disinterested and disengaged from these issues completely to deeply engaged and deeply knowledgeable about the issues. And I think the majority of students fall someplace in between along this curve, but that the ability of the BDS movement to use its Jewish quislings to create a repressive environment is significant, and everybody else goes along, and in this environment as a whole, strong supporters stand out because of their strong support, because it's visible, so very much against the grain, and they seem like a somewhat smaller percentage than they may actually be. And getting people to speak up about issues is difficult in the best of times, and not to mention the worst of times. So I apologize for the unscientific analysis here, but I would commend looking at the Israel Campus Coalition website. Maybe they have some better numbers that I'm missing at the moment.
No, and that's good, and you know, and obviously, you know, to Alex's point, a lot of this is some attitudes. You know, the numbers are, you know, across, you know, vary across the board, and you know, they fluctuate from campus to campus.
Very much so. That's another good, very important point.
you know, and depending on, obviously, in the height of political toxicity, we see these, there is, you know, and I think that, AMCHA is done around the country trying to map the ebb and flow of BDS activism. But again, it's a campus by campus issue. We see it West Coast, East Coast, Midwest, and whatnot, which varies. But, these are, again, part of what we all look at, trying to get the bigger picture. And obviously, there is the change of leadership every year between student groups that bring in more motivation or less motivation, depending on what we see and what we're seeing out there. So, but again, something to obviously look at all around. And of course, we talk about it. Our time is short. I wanted to try to keep us moving, and I just want to keep an eye on the clock. Obviously, a lot to talk about. BDS is not immune to COVID-19. There's a lot of things going on, as to Alex's fantastic, as always, analysis of the social, political, cultural environment that's playing in the environment. And of course, there's obviously bigger questions regarding higher education, which, you know, is, you know, to quote Alex here, you know, this hedge fund that, you know, people are going to try to save. And as long as we are committed to the institution, there will be a lot of money and a lot of investment going into it. Ergo, there'll be also a lot of problems that we'll be facing going forward. SBME, again, is here to tackle a lot of these issues, especially in this time where everybody is cooped at home. Tried out a little bit of analysis, a little bit of humor, which is very important while we're all stuck at home, to try to look at all these issues, to have a little bit of perspective. But let me just say, you know, first of all, above all, please stay safe and healthy. Please take care of yourselves while and during this very concerning time. We wish everybody, you know, health and safety in a specific time. We are here for you. As I said earlier on, we are going to have an ongoing series of calls, and absent us being able to be out there, which we tend to be on the campuses and doing other stuff, but we're going to increase the volume of conference calls in order to stay in touch and engage with all of you during this time. If you hadn't had a chance to ask a question, as I said before, you can email us always at bdsmonitor@spme.org. Again, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And we will again promote and send out notices and invitations to our next calls. Alex, any last words before we wrap up for today?
Well, I'll just reiterate one point. I think 2 points. Again, everybody stay well, and that's the main thing, the bottom line in all this, and that the situation that we come out of in a month or 3 months or 6 months or a year from now will be, on the one hand, very, very different. The world is going to be very different. The universities are going to be very different. On the other hand, they're going to be, there's going to be a lot of sameness. We'll still be here dealing with BDS and anti-Semitism, because they're not going to go away. They're just going to change. And so we will pick up these conversations along the way. And, in the meantime, just be well, enjoy the sunshine. And,
Well, wonderful. Thank you, Alex, as always. We will continue the conversation. Thank you, everybody, again, for joining us this afternoon. And again, be safe and healthy, and we will talk soon. So thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.
Take care, y'all.